Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal here with my partner, Francis Schott. We own Stage Left Restaurant in New Brunswick, New Jersey, and we're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or podcast us through iTunes.
iTunes and many other of the other podcasting services. So hello to everyone.
We're all over the place.
In Central Jersey and beyond. In yesterday's show, we talked.
Thank you, Buzz.
I was wondering where that came from.
Buzz Lightyear.
Yeah, that's
there
where it came go. From. Right. We were talking about the fact that in New Jersey there's a convenience store named Wawa, and there is actually one in the town of Mawa, so there is the Mawa Wawa. And Bruce Johnson, the news director, on the way in, reminded me that many years ago there was a bank in Red Bank called the Red Bank Bank, and there was a branch of the Red Bank Bank in Long Branch. And it was Long Branch branch of the Red Bank Bank, and it actually said that on the sign.
What would happen if that branch were red?
It would be the Red Bank Bank in Long Branch branch. Okay, let's talk about food. Comedy's over. Talk about food.
Comedy never started, my friend. We missed
out
on comedy.
Front page of the New York Times today.
This morning.
Tattooed fruit is on the way is the article. And what's going on here is a new technology being used by produce distributors uses lasers to tattoo fruits and vegetables with their names, identifying numbers, countries of origin, and other information that helps speed distribution. The marks are burned onto the outer layer of the skin and are visible to customers and cashiers alike.
Interesting.
Van Gogh would not be happy.
if his pear said number 94872 on the front of it.
Did Van Gogh paint still likes of fruit? I hope so, because I sound
flowers.
Really ignorant. If
definitely
he didn't.
Flowers.
I know the landscape, the bedroom, the whole thing.
Right.
There had to be fruit in the bedroom somewhere. Anyway, yeah. Well, you know what? I have to say I feel incredibly ambivalent about this because, you know what? It doesn't necessarily do anything bad to the fruit. It doesn't seem like it, you know, I don't know. It's just kind of ooky to me.
I don't know if I've ever heard you say that you were ambivalent about anything.
I know. I'm not a gray area kind of a guy, that's but this like, really falls into it. I mean, it doesn't really harm the fruit. It does make it easier to identify different kinds of fruit. So, mm-hmm. And they even have different – they put on the PLU numbers on it so the cashier doesn't get confused. And
right.
You don't have to – they don't have – I mean, how can they just decide several different
the one thing I like about this mm-hmm. is that one of the numbers on there that we'll be able to identify tells you whether it's organic or genetically modified.
Or fair trade.
Or fair trade. And that, to me, is giving information to the end consumer. And I, you know, I'm always a little leery about like those supermarket cards that you use where they're tracking your purchases to see what kinds of things they can market to you because of, you know, your purchasing patterns. I feel like Big Brother's watching me a little bit. And, you know, with the fruit, I feel like Big Brother's watching a little bit. And that's part of the idea that Big Brother does want to watch. He wants to see where the fruit's going. They want to see where it's coming from. They want to monitor the food supply to partially prevent terrorism and partially just to see where their fruit's being sold.
Well, and I also think that one of the problems that small farmers face, that that people who produce agricultural products sustainably, they face is they need to charge a little. They need to charge some more for their product than somebody who makes it in a big factory. Now, the upside to the consumer is that their product is often also more tasty.
Mm-hmm.
But the cost of production and the risks to these small farmers are greater. And maybe if we can track where they come from, because there's also some counterfeiting. There are also some people selling stuff that's not organic, selling
it
as organic.
You know? I mean, you know the wild salmon story that was in the Times a few months ago.
And
people selling wild things as wild salmon that weren't wild salmon, sometimes for 2, 3, 4 times the price of farm-raised salmon.
And if the producers can mark their fruit and mark the fruit itself, not just the box it comes in, because what's to keep you from taking a box of less expensive apples and putting into a box that says more expensive apples? I mean, this can really benefit the end consumer and the farmer who grows these things.
But what's wrong with the sticker system that's currently in place?
Well, Here, wait. I have a great story here. Here's a quote from Jean Lemieux of Clarksville, Texas. She spent a half an hour one day last week picking off stickers.
Probably Jean, by the way. She's Jean? From Texas.
Oh, yeah.
Not France.
The French last name fooled me. She's a 76-year-old lady, and she says, I was picking all the little stickers from the Piggly Wiggly off my plums and my avocados and my pears and my peaches. Then I had to make fruit salad out of the ones that got hurt when I took off the stickers. And then I had to wash the glue off the other ones before I put them in the fruit bowl. Jean's really having a tough time.
Jean had a tough day with the stickers.
One time, she said, I got up the next morning and looked in the mirror, and there were two of them up in my hair. Oh. Whatever, it is inconvenient to pick up those little stickers.
Come on, it's just not that big a problem. Take a sticker off. Quit it.
Okay, but I like the idea of permanently marking a fruit. But I don't like the idea of changing fruit. It seems to me that fruit is just a basic, fundamental, simple thing. And you know what's going to happen with this? People are going to brand it. I mean, with brand names.
Oh, well, not just branding. One of the things the article said is that it'll be a place to start advertising.
Oh, yeah, here's
a quote. Like the wall of Wrigley Stadium. It'll become an advertising venue.
This is from one of the people who was in Durand Wygant, who has the technology to do this. They say, with the right scanning technology, the produce could even be barcoded with lots of information where it comes from, et cetera, et cetera. You could also have a green pepper that was completely covered with coating, or you could sell advertising space on this pepper.
Eat this pepper at stage left tonight.
Oh, my God.
That's
so
a great idea.
I'm not ambivalent about that.
I love the quote. Can laser coating and beautiful fruit bowls coexist?
I don't think so.
That's great stuff.
Here it says in the article, it talks about students of still life painting might disagree. For literally hundreds of years, artists have immersed themselves in the color and curvature of the perfect peach or apple. So a tattoo sounds like a desecration. Yeah.
Can't you just turn the apple to the other side?
I guess so.
Couldn't,
I don't know.
Couldn't you just arrange your fruit bowl in such a way?
I just got a problem with people writing on my fruit. Just want an apple.
But they're not really writing. They're actually burning.
Yeah. Well, and that's one of the reasons, just so you know how this works, is that the laser works the same way as it works on people. It makes the cut, and it cuts just the tiniest little first layer off to reveal the pigment below.
Just the skin, right. And just the first layer of the skin, not even all the way through the skin.
It cuts and cauterizes at the same time. So this is the same reason it works for laser surgery. This is the reason it works for you. Because so the fruit remains airtight. It doesn't have any negative impact.
You're not going to get a breakage.
So I don't know.
And with the lemons, they're talking about the ink that they're going
to
use is blueberry juice and some other issues there.
I don't know. I'm really ambivalent about it. And, you know, here's another interesting issue. We've talked a lot about foie gras in this show, and we have perhaps the largest producer of foie gras in the United States is Michael Guinor at Hudson Valley Foie Gras. And he has actually come out supporting a law in New York State that will eventually ban the production of foie gras in New York State, but gives him and the existing foie gras producers in New York State enough time to relocate and land on their feet somewhere else. This is a very complex issue, and I think it's going to be very interesting to talk to one of the top producers of foie gras in the country who is actually planning on moving out of the country and taking all these jobs with him. And all the nonsense that is causing him to take this position. We'll talk to him in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:15. Hey, you're back with The Restaurant Guys, Mark Pascal and Francis Shout of Stage Left Restaurant, New Brunswick, New Jersey. And we're going to be talking about, right now, this hour, foie gras. And you may say to yourself, this is not my beautiful house. No, you may say to yourself that I don't eat foie gras. I don't even know what it is. Well, there are a bunch of things going on with the production of foie gras that are important to people, even whether we eat it or we don't. It talks about how food is produced in the United States. Just so you all know what it is that we're talking about, foie gras in the United States is duck liver, but it's duck liver from a fattened liver. It's duck liver from ducks that have been what could be called force-fed, which is sort of related to the way ducks sort of force-feed themselves before they migrate.
That's a little bit of a misnomer.
But in any event, the foie gras people who eat and produce foie gras have come under attack from animal rights activists recently. And there's been a law passed in California that will take effect in a few years that will ban the production of foie gras in California. And the only two states in the United States where we produce foie gras are California and New York. And we have with us on today's show Michael Guinor, who is the co-founder, co-owner, and president of Hudson Valley Foie Gras and New York State Foie Gras, who's probably the largest producer of foie gras in America and one of the largest in the world. Hello, Michael. Thanks for coming on the show.
Michael, welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, it's great to have you on. I want to talk a little bit before we talk about some of the political controversies that are swirling around foie gras production overall. It says in literature by your company that you sort of revolutionized the way that foie gras is made. It's no longer defined by individual farming efforts, but it's a closed, independent production system where the duck and the egg are bred and processed, and both come first. What do you do differently with foie gras than has been done in the past?
Interestingly enough, there have been major changes, yet very few in the 5,000 years that foie gras has been produced. And we produce the very old-fashioned way, where there is a caretaker ratio to ducks of about 300 ducks to one caretaker, which is very cared for.
Sounds better than some kindergartens, Michael.
Correct. And we produce foie gras the same way the Egyptians did for the pharaohs 5,000 years ago on one hand. But on the other hand, what's unique about our operation is that, unlike other countries in the world that produce foie gras, where the different stages of foie gras, namely breeding, feeding, nursery, growing, and so on, are located in different farms, we actually have combined all of the stages of operation, from breeding to marketing, under one roof or under one farm, or actually two farms upstate New York.
And is there a lot of demand for your product? Are there a lot of Americans who like foie gras and order foie gras and want to eat foie gras?
Of course, demand is relative. I assume that people buy more iPods than they buy foie gras.
Well, let's compare it to 10 years ago.
Certainly. There's been a tremendous growth in foie gras, which has reflected the growth in the restaurant business altogether, the high-end restaurant business, whether you look at caviar or truffles or just the number of fine food restaurants and the viewership of your show, probably.
Yep.
We've definitely seen a rise in the super premium products. There are people who are going out and treating themselves to that one big item more and more.
And it's not just a big item. In a sense, foie gras is really a very humble product in a certain sense, but it's a terrific gastronomic treat. And the United States, much like the rest of the world, has discovered its pleasures and has taken to it. And many, many chefs around the country use foie gras almost their signature dish, because it is so, because a chef can so easily express his own personal style using foie gras, which can be used in so many ways. So it certainly has grown, and I would say that in the past 10 years, production probably doubled, maybe a little more than that. It's just that we are limited with how many ducks we can produce, and we stay very conservative in our production.
Well, so let's talk for a moment about, you said you had one caretaker per 300 ducks.
Right.
I mean, let's compare that to a hog farm, where maybe you have one employee per, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands.
Right, or if you compare it to any other poultry operation.
Yeah, let's talk about chicken, I think, a better example.
It's 1 to 30,000.
1 to 30,000 as opposed to 1 to 300.
Right, and you know what? At the end of the day, this all comes down to mortality. If you look at in foie gras production in general, and R in particular, foie gras production, you can expect somewhere in the neighborhood of 4% mortality. Our experience is about 3.2%. If you look at the chicken, turkey, and any other poultry industry, it's anywhere from 10 to 30. So if indeed these ducks were not taken care of and suffering and so on, you would expect a much higher mortality rate than the rate that they actually experienced. And this whole controversy really comes down to just animal rights activists finding an item that's expensive and has this, as you mentioned, misnomer earlier, not to mention that to the naked, uneducated eye, the process could seem inhumane. And when you take all these factors together and you create the kind of PR around it that animal rights activists can afford to do, it's easy to persuade legislators to look into it. However, there have been, I'll let you introduce the next topic, but there have been very, very recent changes, as much as over this past weekend, which we should discuss, which are really turning this thing around.
Well, I think that one of the interesting things that we want to explain to people is that as far as animals are concerned, as far as chickens in agribusiness,
as far as animals that are being produced to be eaten,
chickens are treated much worse, and they lose almost a third of them to death because they're so horribly and cruelly treated that these poor animals die.
And you know what? The issue is, it's window dressing. At the end of the day, the animal rights activists know that there's very little that they can do to affect large companies like Tyson and Purdue and so on. Not to mention that for most people, chicken is a very affordable staple, and most people are not going to put up with chicken going from 99 cents to $1.50.
Right.
And those who do want it that way will buy a particularly produced chicken. The truth is, though, that as much as we would like to have all the chickens in this country produced in a much better way, if it was to be produced that way, I can tell you that there's a whole lot of people out there who probably couldn't afford it.
Yeah.
And so it's nice to be ideal, and it's nice to. But the difference is, of course, with foie gras is that when you bring in this aspect of quote unquote force feeding and the imagery of an animal.
We need to talk a little bit more about that, and we need to
right.
talk about what force feeding is and why that's really an unfortunate misnomer, and we need to use different words to describe it, and what role that plays in the life of a duck. And I also want to
right.
talk more about what you mentioned about chicken in just a moment. You're listening
right.
to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:25.
You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal here with my partner, Francis Schott. Today we have Michael Guinor of Hudson Valley Foie Gras, and we're talking a little bit about how foie gras is produced and why maybe it's not as inhumane as people are accrediting it. Michael, why don't you tell us a little bit about the actual production of foie gras and how these types of things occur in nature as well as on your farm?
Sure. Well, as I said, foie gras has been produced for 5,000 years, and we actually use a duck known as a Moulard. We actually have the paternal breed, which is a Muscovy, and a maternal breed, which is a Pekin, and we actually artificially combine those two breeds to produce this Moulard, which is a particular duck for foie gras production, which is an asexual hybrid, which does not reproduce by itself. So we do produce these ducks for not just foie gras, but, of course, the duck breast and the duck legs
mm-hmm.
For confinement.
Right, we use the whole product.
Absolutely. Everything, as my partner says, everything but the quack.
Right, the bones, the fat, everything gets
exactly.
used.
Exactly. The bones are used for carcass. The carcass is used for stocks. The fat is used to render it and to make for confit making.
But,
the wings
mm-hmm.
are used for confit.
But let's talk about...
Like one of our great guests a couple of weeks ago said, from the rooter to the tutor.
Right.
Exactly. Even the feathers are used for down.
So,
and so we utilize everything the United States Department of Agriculture, which, by the way, is important that we realize inspects us on a daily basis and inspects every duck pre- and post-mortem for any disease or damage.
Mm-hmm. Now, we only have a minute, but I want to give people an idea of how foie gras is produced, what
all
this
right.
controversial process is.
What happens is the ducks have what's called a calcified esophagus, and they gorge on food, which increases the size of their liver.
They do this naturally?
They do this twice a year naturally prior to migration. We use that same Darwinistic theory of survival to produce foie gras on a year-round basis. Basically, by feeding ducks using a tube, through this calcified esophagus, which means they feel no pain, no damage. As a matter of fact, they flock to the food. They eat more than they actually physically need at that moment. That extra food is turned into fat or energy, which is then stored around the liver and will be utilized on migration. We do this process for about 28 days, three times per day, and it's about 3 seconds per feed.
You know what? We're gonna have to come back after the news, but I just want to make one point about this. When
sure.
people look at a tube going down a duck's throat,
correct.
They think, my goodness, I wouldn't like that. But
exactly.
let's remember something.
Exactly.
You're not a duck.
And you never migrate.
And you,
right.
you never, and you don't
and
fly either.
It's not that you're not a duck from a, well, who cares about a duck standpoint, as much as anatomically speaking.
Right, exactly.
Right.
That's what we
ducks
mean.
Do all kinds of things that when they're doing it, I think, you know, I wouldn't like that. But, ducks do
have,
like that.
Right. We do not have a gag reflex. We do not have a
We're going to talk more, Michael, about this in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:30.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with The Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott, and I'm here with Mark Pascal. Together, we own Stage Left Restaurant in New Brunswick, New Jersey, and we are here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. Listen to us every day from 11 a.m. to 12 noon, and you can also reach us through www.restaurantguysradio.com, and we're also podcasting around the world. Find out the details on our website. We are here talking about foie gras with Michael Guinor from Hudson Valley Foie Gras. He is the co-founder, co-owner, and president of Hudson Valley Foie Gras, and he's a pretty revolutionary guy. We're going to talk about the legislative climate and some of the problems that he's facing in a few minutes, but we were talking just before the break about foie gras and how it's produced, and one of the things we talked about is there is this thing called force feeding, and we need to figure out, Michael. Together, we need to come up with our alternative word.
We need a new word for that.
Change that language. But that's where, to make a foie gras, foie gras is the liver of a fattened duck. And to make a fattened duck, what Michael does at his farm and what other foie gras producers have done for thousands of years is you put a tube down the duck's throat and you give it about a cup of cornmeal. Well, this is very similar to what ducks do in their they have calcified esophaguses, which means they don't have a gag reflex, which means they can, if they accidentally eat a stone, it doesn't hurt. Mm-hmm. They have no gag reflex, and they actually sort of like this process, and it's very related to what happens to them in nature. One of the other points that Michael made earlier is that foie gras ducks are some of the best taken care of animals, of any animals raised with animal husbandry for food. And what we're talking about is just because it looks unpleasant for when you put a tube down a duck's throat, remember, it looks unpleasant to you because you're not a duck.
Right.
And the duck flocks to the feeder. And so what you're saying, your point is that it is not cruel to force feed these ducks?
It's completely not cruel, and it's just that the animal rights activists are able to, because it's an expensive product and because you can humanize, in a sense, this aspect of hen feeding, as we call it, or force feeding, as they call it, and then plus you throw in a whole bunch of other stuff, which is completely, you know, some bombastic words like exploding livers and truckloads of dead, things that are completely, absolutely not the case. And mm-hmm. when you paint that whole picture together, you know, you can portray the picture of these nasty, greedy farmers who
right.
are doing these atrocious
but
things.
But in reality, what lives a better life? The chicken that lives in a one-by-one pen for its entire life, or a duck that's ranging on the farm and is well-fed?
Well, the truth is, I hate to make these comparisons because everything is relative, and what may be important to one may not be important to another. You have to look at the facts of this particular farm, and this is what I urge legislatures to do, and not compare to the fact, well, why are we worrying about this when conceivably chickens are worse or children in Somalia are, because it's really not relevant. What is relevant is to look at this process, study it, speak to veterinarians about it, speak to the United States Department of Agriculture about it, and make an educated decision. I welcome the educational part of it, meaning if the animal rights activists feel that they ought to educate people and then let people make up their own minds, so be it. I welcome an open discussion with them at any time. Of course, they mm-hmm. will not have one because when the facts pan out, you see that there's so little relevant truth. And if the legislatures in California actually studied this process, as we're urging them to do in New York, mm-hmm. which they're now doing, you would find that there is very little truth to a lot right. of the window dressing.
Well,
and this is
Michael?
Very important that I mention this to you, if you give me one more second,
sure.
because this is critical. In New York, just to put kind of the State of the Union into this, in New York, in June, at the end of the legislative session, the Senate and Assembly, or especially the Assembly, was to sit down for a discussion about passing this particular legislation, which, as you introduced in the show, we were supporting. The reason we were supporting it is because we were basically told that we have two options, one to literally be put out of business in 1 year, the other is to support this legislation, which would give us 10. Being that we have 200 and change employees, and being that was the winds of change were in that direction, we chose to support the legislation.
Right, better to give me 10 years to redirect where I'm going to go than
exactly.
to close me this year.
Exactly.
Or to move your jobs out of the state.
Well, we've already been approached by the Canadian government
sure.
and to move over. But, of course, New York's our home. Hudson Valley has become our trade brand name, and we want to stay. And so we were basically told, look, the Assembly is definitely going to put you out of business. You should support this. Then I started getting calls from New York Senate saying there's no way we're putting you out of business.
Mm-hmm.
Even if the Assembly passes it, we need to then pass it as well. There's no way we're doing this. We're not the Assembly. We're not going to do it. Turn back on go ahead and pull your support out and take your chances, which then we did. And
hey,
we did
that's
it,
great.
And
good
we did
for
it
you.
The morning of the vote in the Assembly. When the Assembly kind of got wind of that, they pulled the legislation off the books that morning when the vote was supposed to take place. Now, there's no question that, and that was the end of it for this legislative session, there's no question that this will come up again in January
mm-hmm.
when the legislatures reconvene. The animal rights activists are putting really a ton of lobbying pressure on them, and there's more letters going to the Assembly on this subject, and this is a whole discussion itself, than any other subject, than all other subjects put together, believe it or not, including school budgets and so on. However, This will come up again in January. What has happened this weekend, which is critical, and this is something that hopefully everyone will take notice of, is that the AVMA, which is the American Veterinarian Medical Association House of Delegates, met this weekend in Minnesota for their annual meeting. This is the Board of American Veterinarians. One of the issues that was on their table is a vote pulling support away from foie gras production. And I just want to read you this quote from the AVMA.
Please.
This is Saturday, July the 16th.
So this past Saturday.
Correct, 2 days ago, and this is a thrill for us. In a unanimous decision, the American Veterinarian Medical Association House of Delegates, HOD, has defeated a resolution opposing the practice of force-feeding ducks and geese to produce foie gras. Because the observations and practical experience of the veterinarian members indicate a minimum of adverse effect on birds involved, the HOD did not support the resolution opposing force-feeding. Quote, unquote, "We've looked at the science and current production practices and have found it not necessary for the AVMA to take a position either for or against foie gras production at this time," said Dr. Bonnie Beaver, AVMA president.
And that was unanimous.
And that was unanimous.
And that's the veterinarians who actually know the life cycle of the animals and how they're being treated.
And believe me that these guys care about animals.
I was just about saying they're also animal lovers.
Now, what happened is that when these laws started coming up, the AVMA sent several representatives to the farm in May and April. They had the run of the place. They took ducks for post-mortem inspection.
Mm-hmm.
They sent us letters, which are not indicated here, afterwards saying, "We have not seen such a pretty and clean and well-run poultry facility in the United States."
How does it make you feel when a chef like Charlie Trotter comes on and stops selling foie gras?
Because Charlie Trotter is not a chef. He's more a marketer than anything else. And Charlie,
yikes!
Wow!
Ouchie!
Well, he is. Charlie is... I know Charlie... A lot of this is personal.
Uh-huh. Obviously.
Charlie and I go back a very long time, and I know what Charlie's all about, and Charlie knows what I am all about. And at the end of the day, Charlie goes with where he thinks PR. And look, bottom line, we all heard about this, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And Charlie knows where. And you know what? This is one of those instances, kind of like Waterworld, when you step beyond where you should,
uh-huh.
and it turns around on you. Because I can tell you that for most the culinary world, and this is a discussion in its own self, has been waiting for Charlie to do something like this,
uh-huh.
to kind of forget for a second and to put public relation efforts prior to really looking into things. I can tell you that if you go to Charlie's meat and poultry book, the one
right.
the one before last,
yeah,
which was photographed 3 or 4 years ago, there are 8 or 10 foie gras recipes.
Sure, he was one of the...
including a visit to a Canadian foie gras farm.
Yeah, he was one of the big proponents of foie gras.
Actually, we had him on the show and talking about this very topic. When we come back, I want to talk with you a little bit further, because, and I know you don't necessarily believe in the comparisons, but I think it's very germane to the political argument between comparing the McDonald's Chicken McNugget chicken versus your foie gras duck. And if we really cared about animal rights rather than just public relations, as you say, we'd be more against the Chicken McNuggets
right.
chicken. Of course, you'd get slammed down in a heartbeat.
You may not want to get into the politics of it, but we sure do.
Absolutely.
My biggest problem is that I'm afraid that there are a lot of people out there, a lot more. I mean, your show is being listened to by a certain clientele. And
hopefully by millions. Hopefully by millions, because we're podcasting, but we're going to have to pick this up in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:45.
You're back with The Restaurant Guys, Mark Pascal and Francis Schott. Today we're talking with Michael Guinor of Hudson Valley Foie Gras, and we were just discussing the differences between foie gras and a way we produce other poultry in this country, and how foie gras is getting such a bad rap. And Francis and I have talked about the way we produce pork and the way we produce beef in this country, and certainly the way we produce veal. And for people to latch on to foie gras here when there are so many other problems, and certainly much bigger problems than foie gras production, just seems ludicrous to me and seems disingenuous.
Michael?
Yes.
To us it seems like, you know, the producers, look, if you're against killing animals for food, then you're against killing animals for food. But if you say, okay, well, I'm not a vegetarian and I believe that it is okay to kill animals for food, Mark and I always talk about, and we feel there is a responsibility to practice you know, ecologically sound practices, but also humane methods of animal husbandry. We do have respect for animals, and I don't believe chickens should live in cages hopped up on antibiotics and not allowed to move featherless with their beaks cut off. I think that is inhumane. I think that is cruel. I think that a law that said, you know what, price of chicken's going to double, but we can't do this. Morally, we can't do this. These are creatures. They're not meat machines.
Mm-hmm. We subsidize the corn farmers. We could be subsidizing the chicken farmers instead.
But the attack is not against the chicken farmers who are committing these atrocities in huge agribusiness poultry farms. It just seems to me to point that the animal rights people are going for the low-hanging fruit because foie gras is expensive, because it is a delicacy, because it smacks of being French.
And because people don't understand the way ducks eat themselves.
And, of course, this imagery is going around force-feeding in tubes down the throat.
So what we have to come up with is a different word for force-feeding,
well,
and not the French word.
We never use force-feeding.
What do you use?
We either use gavage or we use hand-feeding.
Hand-feeding.
But, of course, the animal rights activists are going to use, everywhere they can, they're going to use a term that is horrendous.
Right. And I just want to reiterate to anybody who might have just tuned in to the show, remember, ducks do this twice a year to themselves. They gorge themselves in order to get ready for migration.
Correct.
And
I mean, look, again, when you look at statistics such as mortality, which are when birds, even more than other animals, are mistreated, they die. When you look at the fact that there's no mortality and there's no damage and there's no pain, there's no suffering, but in France, they actually studied a certain hormone or a certain enzyme that shows stress.
Mm-hmm.
And they found that the ducks in gavage or in hand feeding showed less of this presence than ducks in nature.
Yeah,
you're talking about mental stress.
Yeah, we found the same thing with restaurant owners and people who don't own restaurants.
Absolutely. Mark and I have a saying, actually. We say we run to food. Whenever things are stressful, send down some ice cream and everything will be okay. Hey, listen, I want to read...
Even the ASPCA, I have to say, about 7 years ago, the ASPCA started putting a lot of pressure on us due to animal rights activists. So we said to them, you know what, come up and visit the farm. Now, the ASPCA is a government-funded agency. They actually have peace officers, which means police officers that actually travel with them who are able to actually arrest you. They came up to the farm, they had the run of the place, and they can issue tickets, citations for anything, mistreatment, whatever. They came back with a letter that sent to us that said, after visiting your facility, after taking back ducks with us for postmortem physical checkups, we have found nothing in your facility that indicates any cruelty or inhumane treatment whatsoever.
That's great. Did they take away any ducks that had gone afoul?
Oh, horrible.
Good.
Listen, I'd like to come up and do my own inspection.
No, that's funny.
I'll only need 20 or 30 ducks and 30 or 40 livers, and then we're going to have a party at my house.
You know, the absurdity here is that when you look even further than that, and you look at New York State, and you think, well, what is New York State actually going to achieve should they be able to do this? What they'll achieve is this. They'll put two New York State American foie gras companies out of business, employing about 300 employees, doing approximately $15 million in local revenue. But
what county will
move across the border to Canada, where there's foie gras farms now. They're even gearing up for more production.
Right.
So in turn, not to mention that with all of this public relations, in a way, that the animal rights activists are inadvertently causing for foie gras, sales of foie gras now are higher than they have ever been, including the millennium, meaning December 1999.
Right,
right.
There's more foie gras being sold now because people who have never heard of foie gras are going to a restaurant. They remember they saw a mention of it, they don't remember if it was good or bad, or even more so, people are being told, who make a statement of saying, we're not going to be told what to eat. You have to realize people who eat foie gras know where it comes from, know where it's produced, and will continue eating it. But there's a whole slew of people out there who've never eaten foie gras, who are not only interested because they've seen it mentioned, but further are making an anti-protest saying, well, I'm not going to be told what to eat. So in turn, more ducks, quote-unquote, are being tortured, if you will, than beforehand.
But it's not torture. But more foie gras is being produced, and the animal rights activists are achieving the exact opposite of what they're hoping for.
And New York State legislation will achieve the fact that more foie gras is going to be sold, but it will be coming from Canada. So the whole thing is absurd. Now, you'd think at least the assemblyman who's sponsoring this bill, who has promised me personally that he was going to come and visit the farm, you'd think they would do minimum due diligence and actually studying the process before suggesting a bill.
Especially as you're in rural upstate New York. You're in Sullivan County, and Sullivan County could really not
Sullivan
use...
Sullivan County has done a ton of efforts to bring us in the first place.
Right.
We bought bankrupt egg-laying farms to convert into this niche industry.
Yeah, it doesn't want to lose the 300 jobs that you guys
have. Well, and
have
also, Sullivan County can't really afford to lose many industries. They need to bring many in. I want to read to you a very interesting, just a piece from the Editorial Observer. I think this was in the Times a few weeks back. It was talking about the hand-feeding of the ducks, and it says, the practice done 3 times a day for a month followed by slaughter seemed neither particularly gentle nor particularly rough. It was unnerving to see the tube going down and late-stage ducks waddling bulkily in their pens, but that was no more so than watching the epic gorging at the all-you-can-eat buffet at Shoney's.
and, you know, the New York Times is known to be a very liberal, in a sense, type of publication. If they came up and on their editorial review decided, and trust me, that they would have preferred it to go the other way.
Right.
But if the New York Times came up, and even they came with editorial support
sure.
to foie gras, saying, well, people should maybe make up their own minds, but there's no place for government to jump into this particular aspect.
Right.
This is after observing the farm. Then this thing is ludicrous.
But it's also very interesting. When we talk about California and we talk about some of the other states in the Pacific Northwest that are talking about banning even the possession or consumption of foie gras,
right.
It strikes me that it's very unusual that some of these states may be the first states to legalize marijuana and make foie gras illegal.
Right, but I love Ariane Degen coming out with a product called Too Good to Be Legal for foie gras
Well, Ariane's a very Gascon type of person.
Absolutely. Anyway, Michael, we want to thank you for taking the time to talk with us and our listeners.
It's been a pleasure, Michael. Thank you very much.
Thank you. The only thing I would like to ask you to do is, because the animal rights activists are so able to mobilize their people in sending letters, if we can have anyone who's interested in keeping this product around do the same and write letters to the assembly, to the New York State Assembly saying, well...
We're going to communicate with you, Michael, and we're going to put information about that up on our website and link our website to yours so we can have people, number one, go out and try some of this delicious treat, and number two, if you feel strongly about this, write a letter to your legislator, especially if you live in New York State or California and you're listening to us on podcasting. Thanks again, Michael Genner from Hudson Valley Foie Gras. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:55.
Hello and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark Pascal and Francis Schott. We own Stage Left Restaurant in New Brunswick, and we've been talking about foie gras with Michael Genner from Hudson Valley Foie Gras.
Yeah, we had the owner of Hudson Valley Foie Gras on, and you may not have, if you were listening to the show, you may not have realized what the vitriol was when we mentioned Charlie Trotter. Wow!
There was definitely some angst there.
Sure,
huh?
Angst, anger. Charlie Trotter is one of the most prominent chefs in America. And Michael Genner, and he has recently come out, and he has not, in fairness to Charlie Trotter, spoken out against foie gras. He said, I'm taking it off my menu. You all do what you want.
He didn't even say it. He was approached, and someone asked the question.
He just took
He's
it
done
off
it for 3 years, took it off the menu. And
I got no problem with Charlie Trotter.
Yeah.
But Michael Genner does. and when pressed, Charlie Trotter said, listen, I don't want to serve it anymore. I've served it in the past. I've changed my mind about it, and I'm not serving foie gras. And Michael Genner came on, just attacked Trotter, said he's not a real chef. I think that's going a bit far.
Yeah, he went over a little
I've
bit.
I've eaten the man's food. He's a chef.
Yeah.
But
he is also a tremendous marketer.
Absolutely. And his books are great, and he's a very important force in the food world. But I have to say, I'm all for foie gras. I serve it. I eat it. And Charlie doesn't mind that I eat it. That's all.
Why don't we tell a few things that we can do with foie gras?
If you've never had foie gras before, it's not... It's not easy to prepare. Well, actually, it is easy to prepare, but it's also simple to mess
up. It's very rich and a real delicacy for those of you who've never had it
if
before.
If you go to Wegmans and look for a little advice, or you buy one of Charlie Trotter's old books, he'll tell you how to make foie gras. Or you can email us at Stage Left. I know we have one recipe for foie gras up.
Absolutely.
And it's really worth a try. And if you haven't tried it before, it's not like liver at all. My grandmother made us eat liver once a month.
I can't stand calf's liver.
Calf's liver, awful.
Liver and onions was...
But foie gras is really remarkable, and foie gras is sometimes made into pâté, but a real foie liver and some of the best foie gras in the world is being produced right here in America.
It's one of the most interesting tastes in the world, and it's not for everybody. Not everybody enjoys it, but those people who love it swear by it. Also, right now, we have on our menu...
At Stage Left,
we're doing seared foie gras with New York State foie gras with New York State cherries, and really, really a great combination.
Yeah, foie gras works really well.
The fresh cherries right on at the same time. same time.
So visit our website or drop us an email. You can all email, and all of you out there in iPod land, email us so we know where everyone's listening to us from. We see a bunch of you out there from Harvard on our statistics. Isn't that wild? I love the internet. It tells you where the people are coming from. Email us, mark@restaurantguysradio.com or francis@restaurantguysradio.com.
Mark, if you want the right answer.
Yeah, exactly. We'd love to hear from you. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450, and the time is 12 noon.